This podcast is recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. The country we now call Australia was built on the stolen lands of hundreds of unique Indigenous nations, and we recognise that as white women, we continue to partake in and benefit from the act of colonisation. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. Welcome to Book Slut, a podcast bringing erotica out of the gutter and into a snobbier gutter. Hi, my name is Abby.
And I'm Sam. It should go without saying that this podcast is not safe for work, so put your headphones in. Testing the microphone. Testing the microphone. Testing.
Schweppes.
You're burping for a while.
Yeah, no, I'm going to burp, but it's not quite ready yet, so
okay,
be prepared
okay.
to edit that out.
All right.
So, this fortnight, I want to talk about class.
Just a small topic.
Yeah, because I felt like, you know, we've been talking a lot about kind of really niche issues that have been happening in romance, and I think a lot of what we've read actually has involved real kind of classist themes.
Definitely.
And so I decided, you know, how about we actually address this head on? So we were talking about it and I was like, you know what? We've read so much about billionaires and whatever. I would really just love to find something that flips that on its head and has a woman who's a billionaire.
Yeah.
So I found a book on Amazon.
Speaking of class.
That was called Love and Money, a BWWM billionaire romance like no other. And we spoke about what BWWM means. Essentially, it's a romance genre with black women, white men. But I think the black woman, white man genre is actually quite large.
Yeah, okay.
A lot of it written by African-American women, which this book is also written by. Esther Banks is her name. So obviously, the romance genre has race issues, and we've spoken about it a bit before in the side note that we did on the Romance Writers Guild, but it's intrinsic, and it goes throughout so many of these books, and we definitely want to talk about it. It's been something that we've had on our minds for a long time, but as white women, we're kind of hoping that we'll be able to chat to someone with lived experience so that we're not kind of preaching to the choir, essentially, on this. So there are a lot of race issues that go throughout this book, written by a black woman about a black woman, and we'll touch on it, but we're not going to dive too deeply into it in this episode. It's just going to be about the class differences, I think.
Yeah, I think it's good to scope it down that way while keeping in mind that there is a level of intersectionality with all of these things. Like, we often talk about things from a gendered perspective, as is kind of like our focus for a lot of the time. But I just don't think it's possible to completely remove that discussion from conversations around class and around race.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are some kind of points of this book that were quite interesting for me to think from a kind of critical race perspective. That were just kind of throwaway lines.
Yeah, okay.
That I was like, well, that's kind of interesting. So, sorry, I'll go back to the beginning. At the beginning of this story, I was like so into it. I thought it was quite cool. There's this kind of really empowered, independent black woman who is a billionaire. She's taking over her dad's company and her dad's a billionaire.
Because that's the only way that people become billionaires, right?
Well,
just keep that in mind.
Yeah, exactly. And her name is Tamara. She speaks four languages fluently and is just kind of like, she's just kind of great. I quite enjoyed her as a character. But there is this point where she's going home to her family's home and it's this mansion. And I don't actually know where the story is set, but, and it's noted in the book, the house was owned by slave owners.
Yeah,
or
right.
Human traffickers, realistically. And she says that, you know, her mum takes a certain amount of pride in owning a house that was once owned by these people.
In a sense of like taking it back.
And a sense of showing, you know, like how far the world has come that a black family can own this kind of house. So it does come up throughout the book quite a bit. But it doesn't really come up in the relationship between the two characters.
Which surprises me, really. I feel like it would.
Yeah, I guess maybe it's like, I mean, and this is fundamentally kind of where I'm going with the class discussion. It's just not sexy.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
Like it's kind of like, maybe it's outside of the ambit of romance to an extent to have that.
Like, how much can you include that kind of narrative and conversation and like critique in a romance book and it still be a good sexy time?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And if you're talking about escapism, like I do fundamentally believe that the things that we read should be informed by these sorts of things and should include them in a certain way, but maybe not to the extent of like paragraphs on the issues that are surrounding these matters.
Yeah. And you know what makes me think of as well is I think way back in like, I don't know, episode 3 or 4, I don't know when it was, we spoke about sort of like the origin of this idea of pornography and what was erotic, and that used to be regarded as kind of like anything that was outside of the norm in terms of satire, critical thinking about religion, critical thinking about politics, all of that stuff around the sex that used to sort of form part of this idea of eroticism and how we've lost that now and we've kind of turned into this medium that's quite safe and like warm fuzzies. And there's no place for discussions about race and class in a warm fuzzy book.
Yeah. But they perpetuate it.
Yes.
You know, like in a lot of ways that's so, why I'm kind of like, everything should be informed.
Absolutely. You can't, it feels like you can't get away with perpetuating without engaging with it critically.
Yeah.
In my opinion. Like it's lazy.
Yeah. So with this story, it's about a woman called Tamara, who's the billionaire, who is taking over her company from her dad. But there's a very big point in the book made that it's like, it's not just nepotism. She is a very, you know, whatever, go-getter woman.
Yeah, okay.
She is having her 30th birthday at a club, which sounds like, quite honestly, the worst club. So I've got a description about the club because I just really found it quite great. The bar is called the White Tiger.
Uh-huh.
It's a 3-level repurposed warehouse, completely white interior, from the elegant chandeliers that dangled overhead to the zebra print chaise lounges.
Oh no.
And booths that occupied all 3 floors.
Why do people feel like that's sexy? I don't know.
All white would make me just be like, I'm going to dirty everything in here.
Also, it's like clinical. It's like, ugh.
But she really loves this club, right? And right at the beginning, it's kind of, it's talking about her and she's there with her friends. And it's this, you know, it's a jazz lounge, but turns into like an R&B club on Fridays and Saturdays. And then it swaps. So this book swaps point of views from her to the man who is called Jason. And
pick a more white man name.
Yeah. And it swaps to his point of view and he's talking about how the club actually makes him feel uncomfortable.
Oh.
Like just because it's a bit fancy, it's a bit ritzy. And
is it? Doesn't sound like it.
It's all white. It's got zebra chaise lounges.
Isn't it funny how rich people like often just really lack any kind of taste?
Any kind of class,
yeah.
We could say. So they're both there.
Why is he there?
Well, so this is kind of another kind of interesting thing that gets thrown out. He's there with his friend, and his friend really loves black women.
Okay.
And so it's like this thing.
If it's a thing, it's problematic.
Yeah. So they meet at this bar. He offers to buy her and her friends a drink, and then she's like, oh, it's actually covered on the tab because I know the owner, right? So they have a really sexy dance.
Oh.
And to be honest, the sexy dance is quite hot.
Oh, yeah.
So we're like, and then they kiss. And we're kind of right at the beginning of the book, and I was feeling real optimistic.
You're like
at this
bright-eyed, bushy-tailed.
I was like, she's quite a badass.
Fresh out of uni. A all the hopes and dreams of the future.
Waiting to be crushed. Yeah, she's quite cool. She's quite a cool character. He seems really normal, which is great.
He seems a
misogynist.
He seems normal. He seems like he's not awful.
Why don't I have a boyfriend yet? My standards are so high. And then they have this quite hot, sexy dance, which is like a lot of grinding, a lot of like, you know, just feeling each other. And as someone who enjoys a sexy dance, I was quite into it at this point.
Yeah.
And then they make out. And that's pretty much it. That's all you
get. On the dance floor?
On the dance floor.
Okay. Yeah.
I've also been known for
yeah.
quite a few makeouts. Having seen on the dance floor.
Many a time.
For some reason, my like dislike of PDAs yeah, it's does funny not extend to a dance floor.
It doesn't translate anywhere else. Like, you are very, I would say, standoffish. In any other context.
Until I start dancing, you know? I don't know.
Bets are off at that point.
I don't know. Then she turns up to work the next day and she's taking over this new business, right? And he works for her.
Oh. No.
Twist! So he is actually the public relations, like the head of public relations for the company. And quite like... quite clued in. He has to present this initial presentation to her, and she's very impressed by like his knowledge. And
wait, so at this point is she like, whoops, made out with that guy?
Yeah,
I guess I'll listen to his presentation now.
Yeah, essentially they're like, oh, we'll introduce you to the heads of the company.
Oh, that's a whoops.
Yeah, and then she's like, ugh, okay, but that's fine. I'm a grown ass adult.
Mistakes happen.
Exactly.
As long as you're not, like, fucking on the photocopier.
Yeah.
Or does that come?
Well.
Sorry. I'll let you take the reins again.
So then she's down a PA.
Right.
And so she decides to somehow manipulate the situation so that he will be her PA.
That sounds like a bad plan.
Right? And it's kind of like, you don't have to demote this man to date him. You know?
Oh, is that a demotion for him?
Well, I mean, like the head of public affairs to the personal assistant of the CEO.
Oh, yeah, no, that's... it's a weird move.
Exactly, right? Like, it's like, what skills does he have for this
also,
job?
Also, like, if you recognize it, you're like, I'm attracted to this person. Maybe I don't want them to be my direct report.
Exactly, right? Like,
or maybe I do. Depending on what 60. Gets you off.
But I mean, it kind of... made me think about the way this plays out for the male billionaire scenario, yeah, which is also quite similar. Normally yeah. it's like a secretary or a PA totally. Or something that goes in and so it's, you know, relatively similar. Oh, and also he's 6.5 feet.
That's tall.
It's so tall. It's like, oh, God. He's this like massive this? Piece of man muscle kind of. When was it written? I actually didn't look.
I'm sorry, I'm still recovering from massive piece of man muscle.
I mean, that's paraphrased.
Yeah, but...
Let's not give them all of my ideas for my romantic novel.
I feel like that's such a stereotypical thing that women are into.
So one of the things that I was reading about the billionaire trope, essentially saying that it can be linked to patriarchal notions of, like, the carer and the father symbol.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Thanks, Freud.
Yay. That they have the means to take care of you.
Yeah, not just financially, but also physically because they're ripped.
Yeah, and so in this instance where he doesn't have the means to take care of this woman financially because she has her own means, it becomes kind of like more important that he's like this tall, ripped dude. I mean, I don't know. Maybe that's me reading too much into it, but we do have a podcast entirely based on this.
The whole point is to read too much into it. We should have just called it
Reading Too Much Into Shit. And there is this point later on in their relationship where, you know, they go out for a date or whatever. And this is quite, there's a lot of build up in this relationship. It's like,
I mean, welcome to romance.
Yeah. He's at PA for a fucking long time. And
why would he accept that demotion?
Yeah, I don't know.
Was he just like, I just want to be close to you?
No, he wasn't.
My name's Jason.
My name's Jason. I'm a white man. No, he was very like, this is unprofessional. You know, like he was quite upset by it.
Yeah, okay.
But it felt like he kind of didn't really have an option.
Oh, no.
But they go on a date and he pays for the date. Like, he pays for them going out for drinks.
Yeah, okay.
And it's written in the book, you know, the gesture had gone miles for his pride. It was hard to try and treat a woman you were interested in when you knew that she could probably buy the establishment that you took her to. Which, again, I thought was a really interesting comparison to, like, when it's a man billionaire and they treat women, they treat the women to like absolutely everything, and it's never a question.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, it's like, oh yes, I will go in your helicopter, and oh yes, like I absolutely do deserve this like 5-course meal at a fancy restaurant.
Yeah.
And there's never this question of like, oh, my pride means that I should take the tab or whatever.
So is what you're saying essentially that because the roles were flipped in this book, it gave space to even consider that there are like issues coming up with that?
Yeah, I think the issues of class were raised kind of a bit more specifically.
Because it was out of the norm.
Yeah, and I mean, maybe not, again, if you weren't reading into it.
It's so hard to tell what's like, what would it... What would you normally pick up on if you were just reading it to, like, jerk off to?
So they go to this work event and there's a quote that says, the more she drank... I think, to be fair, I think this is tongue-in-cheek, but I was still like, woof. The more she drank, the easier it was to imagine she could just walk up to Jason, rip his clothes off, and demand to have her way with him. She was his boss. That was allowed, right?
Nope. No, not allowed.
I think there are many rules,
HR many laws, no,
that say that is not allowed.
Oh.
And
I think it's really interesting though, this like the transcendence of like being a boss in the bedroom versus being a boss in the boardroom. Like there are very distinct things.
Well, yeah, I read a so I went on to Quora.
Oh, good. High quality content.
And there was a question saying, why are billionaire romance books so popular? Don't most of them have the same storylines of a CEO meeting a normal or poor girl? And
good question.
There weren't that many answers, but this one man who writes romance, apparently, wrote, you know, after I'd completed one set, I felt there was nowhere else to go. I realized the same thing you did. They're largely rich man meets poor or at least less rich woman. Would it work if the roles were reversed and rich woman met less rich man? It might simply turn into a dominant woman seduces male employee story. That might appeal to you, but I have no inclination to write it.
Is that not the same?
Yeah, it's exactly the same as what the male version is, but for some reason...
It just stands out to him as a different...
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Hmm.
So it's like a, you know, oh, well, if it's a woman version, then it flips.
Yeah, that's okay. All right. Sure, Quora respondent. If that's how you want to play it.
I mean, the other respondent said, it's not exciting to have the heroine meet Bob the plumber and go through typical life problems. People read novels to get away from real life and into a world with money, beautiful locations, and few limits.
And, you know, I don't disagree with the last part of that. I don't know about the first part about Bob the plumber. Because, like, is that less sexy than meeting, like, Jill the...
Billionaire?
Well, no, but, like, the equivalent of...
Jill, like, Jill the secretary or yeah, Jill the
exactly.
hairdresser.
Like, what's the difference there, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think that it really does tie into... Especially in... So, more so in the romance genre than erotica... Given that there's a higher percentage of women readership in that space, and that part of the fantasy is upward class mobility. Mm-hmm. It's moving from maybe you're working class and you're moving up to middle class, or maybe you're middle class and moving up to like billionaire fucking status. That's part of the allure, I think. And so it wouldn't be as fulfilling to read something about, you know, your average Jane falling in love with your average Joe.
But then, I mean, like, are rich women not reading romances? You know?
Well, I actually read an interesting article that like looked into kind of like the historical context of Harlequin novels.
Mm.
So for those of you who've been listening in for a while, we'll know that Harlequin is like one of the biggest publishers of romance novels. They are the publishing house that does Mills and Boone, for example. And they looked at this piece called Romancing the World, Harlequin Romances, The Capitalist Dream, and the Conquest of Europe and Asia. And they essentially looked into...
Harlequin's also owned by what's-his-face?
Murdoch.
Just
evil.
Well, we're talking about class.
Yeah, well, and it's... like, reading this, I was like, fuck, like, you really can't... It's so easy to look at a romance novel and be like, oh, this is just like a happy-go-lucky, like fun, fancy-free romance novel. It means nothing. And then reading into it, I was like, oh, it actually plays a really big role in politics of not just between men and women, but also class politics and international politics. And so what essentially this piece argued was that in the early 20th century, Harlequin novels kind of represented like this American ideal of capitalism. And so as you're going through all kinds of international conflicts and essentially like a tension between capitalism and communism, Harlequin novels represented like this ideal of like wealth and financial prosperity and American, like all American values and these really like solid heteronormative family values and whatnot. And so once like the Berlin Wall came down and there started to be a bit more of a pickup of like capitalist ideology across Eastern Europe, like the sale of Harlequin novels like skyrocketed through the roof. And there's this one little fact that stood out to me, like the Berlin Wall came down and within hours, Harlequin employees were handing out free books at all of the border crossings.
Oh my God.
They gave out about 720,000 books for free, mostly for citizens in the former communist nations. And that was like their first kind of encounter with democracy and capitalism in this kind of like popular format.
And in a real like rose tinted glasses kind of like
exactly
vibe. Yeah. Wow.
And so part of that was like the novels, like the fantasies are about financial empowerment just as much as they are about like romantic fantasies and about a lot of these, the women in these books also have a level of some level of autonomy and this idea of like, if you're a working class woman, the prospect of dallying in a romance or marrying someone for love was really foreign at that point. It was like you were marrying for financial stability, economy, or some kind of level of security. So this it represented so much more than just a love story, which I found really interesting. Anyway, getting to my point, one of the things that stood out was that, like, for example, they also looked at Japan as a market for Harlequin novels. And what they found was that, so this the sale of Harlequin novels did really well in Japan initially, but then once their economy grew to match that of America's and that it lost that financial appeal, it lost the like aspirational kind of capitalism appeal, it stopped. The sales essentially like plummeted because once it was just about the romance and all this kind of like Americana nonsense, the Japanese people were like, fuck this.
And so what, it's like the idea is that now we've gone into billionaires because that's actually a step up that
I guess
90% of us are never going
to
achieve.
Well, it's like aspirational to the next level.
Yeah. And what 90%, 98%.
But what I thought was interesting was like, yeah, this point of like, once Japan reached this a similar level, that allure wasn't there anymore for just a plain old romance novel.
But I mean, but it's interesting because the allure is still there for us, right? Or for Western nations, because we're still buying these things. But when you look at things like 50 Shades of Grey, all of that stuff is the billionaire story.
Yeah, you're not just you're not aspiring to like a middle manager.
No, exactly. You're not aspiring to exactly these like middle range you know, middle class ideals anymore. Yeah. It's all like the 1%.
Yeah, the fantasy is that a billionaire will whisk you off in his helicopter.
Yeah.
Ooh, I just automatically gendered that. Gross.
Yeah, we're disgusting.
Ugh. But yeah, I went down a real rabbit hole learning about all of that.
No, that's super fascinating. It's
interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a good time to take a break.
Yeah, that's true.
Come back in a bit.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So let's get to the sexy part of this book.
Sorry, I didn't mean to like spit.
Esther Banks, the author. Great characters. I didn't like the sex.
Oh.
The sex was not great for me.
Okay.
But
like great maybe for others?
Oh yeah, maybe. I mean
different
yes.
strokes, different folks, all exactly. of that.
Something that came completely out of the blue and I think is actually worth an entire other podcast, but we won't talk about it here, is what happened is that Tamara's ex-partner, like, bursts into the office and mm-hmm. is obviously abusive.
Oh.
And Tamara gets very scared and is very kind of, like, in shock and can't really deal with this. And this man bursts in and is essentially like, I want my fucking money, blah, blah, blah. I had to put up with you. You should pay me kind of vibe. And then when Jason tries to...
I mean, that's not how shit relationships work.
Yeah.
The amount of times I could bill shit men yeah. terrible days.
I want my money. Yeah. And then when Jason tries to protect her, this... I don't even remember his name, but this other character is like, you know, oh, I see that you're, you know, fucking this guy in your office now, and then kind of leaves yelling about how they're in a relationship. So then Jason and Tamara, who have been not in a relationship, kind of, but kind of are,
mm-hmm.
Decide, fuck it, everybody knows now, let's just get into a relationship.
Yeah.
Right? And that's how the relationship goes on. And I think what is really problematic in particularly romance books is how they use instances of family violence and this abusive ex as a plot point.
Yeah.
It made me quite uncomfortable. I think it's happened a few times yeah. in books where there's like this abusive ex who acts as an example of how this good guy
yeah.
can protect the woman yeah. from this ex.
Yeah.
And I think it's definitely something that we should kind of talk about a bit more in detail, but that is something that happens in this book as well. And then after this, they decide to become official, Facebook official, and they start dating and they haven't had sex yet.
Okay.
So there's still like, there's so much build up.
Quite a lot has happened at
yeah,
this point.
Yeah, yeah. And they're about to have sex. Oh, they do kiss and she explains... She describes the kiss in this way that I thought was possibly the least sexy way of describing a kiss.
I'm glad that you're reading the least sexy bits to me.
I know, like, honestly, there's very little sex in this book. Like, very,
it's
very little sex.
It's just money play. They're just rubbing money on each other. Damn. I mean, that's got to be a fetish, right?
Yes, surely. I would be into that.
I was going to say, I feel like I'd probably get on board.
Money would feel good, I think. It's kind
but
of
also
cold,
then I'd be like, it's filthy. So many people have touched it.
But, so they kiss, and I can't even remember when this is, but at some point they're kissing. And it says, as his tongue delved boldly past her lips, the woman clung to him. It was only a few short moments before her own dexterous muscle snaked out to meet his. Twining around it in an intricate and sensual dance that had him rising in his dress slacks.
Oh, hello. dexterous tongue, though.
Dexterous and twining around okay, it.
So I have this very vivid...
Snaked out.
I have a very vivid memory of being in primary school and there being a challenge to...
Oh, tie a snake
yeah.
with your tongue?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it being...
It was always kind of sexual.
It always was. And the teachers never said it, obviously, as they shouldn't, but it... I remember it very distinctly being like, this is how you tell if someone's a good kisser.
Yeah, exactly. It was this whole thing. Yeah. Gross. So dexterous tongues. She's a fan. And then they almost have sex. But it gets interrupted because Tamara has to take a phone call.
She's a very busy lady. She's with very a lot busy on her lady. Plate.
She has to take a phone call from Japan. She's chatting away in Japanese and she has to run
very
to the
cool.
office.
Very cool.
Pretty cool. Anyway, and then she comes back to his place afterwards. This is like hours afterwards, right?
He wasn't like strapped to the bed or something, was he?
No. He was asleep. It was okay. like 1 a.m. or
okay.
whatever.
Okay.
And she snuggles in and he's still hard.
No, he's not. But
so,
sure.
She says, you know, his erection had not abated.
How would she know?
I mean, she wouldn't know, but also like he's just erect all the time. And then the description of sex, I just have a couple of examples.
Mm-hmm.
I think she explains it like two or three times that they have sex throughout this whole book. Never uses a condom.
Oh.
Yeah. It's just like...
But he is working class.
You should be...
It was meant to be a joke, but it came out really snobby.
That was so good.
I mean that in jest. Oh, God. Your face. I really caught you off guard there.
So the thing that kind of got me about this is it's like normally, I mean, generally speaking, there's three ways I think that people talk about sex in these books from what I've worked out. It's either you explicitly talk about a condom, you don't mention it, like you don't mention anything about it. Or it's like quite explicit that they haven't used a condom.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this one is quite explicit that no condom has been used.
Oh.
Firstly, there's this part that I thought you would appreciate. It says, you know, his kisses stole her labored breath and soon he was so deep that she could swear that each stroke kissed her womb.
Ugh, I hope it didn't.
Just
for her sake.
Painful. Stop.
Go to the
Try
doctor.
Try a different position. But, so we have these two things that brought up the condom issue. Their bodies were straining against each other and a hoarse shout escaped him. I quite liked the fact that he made noises. Doesn't often
yeah.
happen in this,
yeah.
in the books.
It's not a common reference in a book. It's also, I feel like it's not super like commonly acknowledged in like everyday life.
Yeah. More men should make noises.
Absolutely.
I'm a fan of a man
making
noises.
I need a little signal.
I
like,
need some feedback.
Is this okay?
Yeah.
Is this good?
Do you enjoy
it? I mean,
this?
It doesn't have to be like, ugh. In fact, maybe don't.
Similar to women. I mean, it doesn't have to be like, ugh.
Or
like, ah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so a hoarse shout escaped him as she felt his warmth gush between her thighs.
Is that him coming?
Well, yeah.
His warmth.
His warmth.
Okay.
His warmth.
Sorry, I'm
his
not picking
gushing.
Up on all of that.
His warmth is gushing, Sam.
Of course it is. Okay.
The other one, pressing his hips flush against hers, he cleaved deep, making her gasp seconds before the warmth of him coated her inner walls.
I mean...
It feels like a Jackson Pollock painting at
yeah.
that point.
Yeah. It's quite violent. Cleaved just makes me think of like one of those...
Sheathed?
Well, yeah, but also one of those like big knives, those big like...
Cleavers?
Yes, a cleaver. Yes, actually, that's exactly what I meant. Thank you.
It's weird how that would make you think of that.
Whatever. Sure.
So they have sex. No condoms. Is
yeah.
the point of that.
You know, so in my opinion, the only time it would be okay, really, nowadays, for it to be explicitly without a condom is if there is also some kind of context for that being okay.
Exactly, right? Like some sort of conversation about them being in a monogamous relationship, which so often these stories are.
Yeah.
Then why not have a throwaway line about it or something?
Doesn't need to be much.
So much of these stories often revolve around, the plot point is around, like, are we monogamous? Is this a thing? Is this serious or not? If that's a plot point, why isn't the condom usage also tied to that plot point?
Yeah, it could be symbolic of it as well. And be like, well, now that we're monogamous, you can be inside me freely.
I can feel you skin to skin.
Oh, this got to a gross place today.
Your penis can kiss my womb.
If anyone listening doesn't find that upsetting, like, please just Google a diagram.
Yeah, no penis should be kissing wombs.
No.
It's going to be painful. So the story, to finish up, essentially her ex kidnaps her.
Fuck.
Yeah. No, it gets real, like, he kidnaps her.
It was, like, going along quite nicely until that point.
Yeah, it gets, he kidnaps her and has a gun to her head.
Fuck.
And America. And
shit.
Then the police, for some reason, allow Jason to come along on their kind of, like, they've discovered who it is. And also, they take so long trying to find out who it is, and it's, like, very obvious that it's her ex.
I mean, it should be number one suspect, right?
Right. After Jason, probably. Then they save her, and then Jason then becomes very protective of her because he's very worried about, you know, the fact that she's rich and that she's always going to be a target for blackmailers and people trying to do her harm to try and get money, because that's what this guy was after.
Right.
And then they break up.
Oh.
Because she's like, well, this is who I am. Like, if you can't handle it, then you need
also
to leave.
Also, like, she probably has security for this exact job.
Well, this guy got through the security. Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah. And then there's this discussion about how, you know, Jason used to just want to go to the local burger joint, but now he wants to go somewhere.
He should just be a regular old man.
Now he wants to go somewhere that has, like, security all of the time, right? And then there's this whole Notting Hill-esque moment where she has decided she's going to step down from the company because she can't deal with it anymore because she doesn't have Jason and she's just, like, sad about
it. No, Tamara, no.
And then Jason's like, I love you and I'm willing to stick by, like, I'm sorry that I left and I'm willing to stick by you even if you get kidnapped for your money and for mergers and whatever.
Right.
And I thought it was quite interesting that, like, her class, her position as having money was used in this story as a weakness.
Yeah, that's fascinating to me.
Whereas it's never used that way for men.
No, because normally, so because the stereotypical story is that it's the lower class woman and the higher class man. That's the sort of formula, right? Like, I got quite in deep in the academia of all of this because there's a relatively, no, it's not a large amount. There's a relatively small amount of academia around sort of classism in romance novels. And one of the things about it is that there's this common sort of trope of, if you've got, it's like this fantasy of, like, star-crossed lovers kind of thing. And it's like the love is strong enough that it can bridge the gap between their two worlds or whatever. Mm. But the cost of that is that the lower class person normally has to sacrifice their behavior, their family, their upbringing, their way of life, and join the whoever the person is who's in the upper class to become essentially worthy of their love. And we see that in all kinds of pop culture. The main one that stood out to me was My Fair Lady, because that's a classic example.
Yeah.
But what I find really interesting about this story is that even though the roles have been reversed, it seems like there's something about the gender and maybe the race as well that's playing in there, that she's still the one sacrificing, or at least toying with sacrificing her position.
And yeah, absolutely. But I mean, it's also interesting in that I think there is an aspect of that, him sacrificing his position for her in that, like, now that I'm thinking about it, the whole story, we never meet Jason's family.
Yeah, right.
We meet all of her family, you know, like, we know where they come from, what their interests are, all of that. Jason is just this, like, person who was created out of nothing to be there for Tamara.
Yeah, of course.
Which is kind of interesting. But also the thing is, like, he's not her secretary. He's not her PA. He's the manager of the public affairs, like, part of the organization. So he's one of the managers of this business. He's not, like, he's not low on the food chain, right?
No,
like,
no, it's not nothing.
Yeah, he's still, and the way that they talk about it, he's still presented as, like, really knowledgeable, really on top of his stuff, like, very respected in his work, which doesn't happen with women.
No.
They're often positioned as, you know, like we saw with 50 Shades of Grey, kind of bumbling, clumsy, you know, damsels in distress.
Yeah.
Whereas this is seen as, you know, Jason's quite on top of it. And then when Tamara is kidnapped, she's positioned in this damsel in distress role. To be fair, it's not entirely like she's not helpless. She really kind of gets herself out of it. But then it's also interesting that him protecting her becomes the problem, right, in their relationship, that he's kind of too protective of her at this point and she can't deal with it anymore because she's quite an independent character. He often mentioned that he was, like, intimidated by her.
Yeah.
And that when they broke up, there was a line saying, you know, I guess he wasn't supposed to be with a powerful woman.
Okay.
You know, so there is something intrinsically different about having a class difference where the woman is of a higher class than the man.
Yeah. So what happens in the end of the book then?
Oh, they get together. Like
they broke up.
No. So she's like, I'm stepping down from the company, and her friends knock on his door essentially, and they're like, do you know that she's stepping down from the company? He's like, what the fuck, no. And so he races over there, a la Notting Hill, and is like, don't step down from the company. I love you. You know, this company is who you are.
I'll support you in whatever you want to do.
Yeah. Like, I'll support you. I'm so sorry. I was an idiot. Blah, blah, blah. And then she's
also
like,
I love money.
Also, it's great that you're a billionaire.
I want a beautiful bathtub.
And so they end up together.
Right.
Yeah.
Happily ever after.
Yeah. So it's
and I'm sure that's the last time that class ever causes rifts in their relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. They'll be totally fine. I have a lot
it's
of...
It's not like they have a completely different upbringing, completely different experiences and social expectations, whatever.
Nah, they'll be good. I've got a lot of faith. So one of the things I was looking at online was essentially like, oh my God, why are there so many stories about billionaires? You know, how many billionaires can there possibly be in the world? Which I'm like, flawed argument, because it's fiction. It's a fantasy. Yeah. Like, how many fucking dukes are there? Well, were there in the 19th
Duke?
Century?
Duke? He's not a duke. Sorry.
But then I was like, how many billionaires are there in the world?
Did you Google it? How many are there?
As of March 18 in 2019, Forbes counted 2,095 billionaires.
Okay, that's not that many. I mean, it's more than I thought.
It is more than I thought as well, but it's not that many. But Forbes, their paragraph on this, I just found so fucking funny. For those of you who haven't yet guessed, billionaires are dumb and shouldn't exist.
Eat them all.
Eat the rich. But this whole, like, the first paragraph was like, the richest people on earth are not immune to the coronavirus. Yeah. Global equity markets imploded, tanking many fortunes. As of March 18, when we finalized this list, Forbes counted 2,095 billionaires, 58 fewer than a year ago.
Oh, no.
And 226 fewer than just 12 days earlier.
Oh.
When we initially calculated these net worths, of the billionaires who remain, 51% are poorer than they were last year.
Oh, what a shame.
In raw terms, the world's billionaires are worth $8 trillion, which is down $700 billion.
You know what? Once you start talking about billion dollars and trillion dollars, it
means
nothing.
I don't give a fuck.
It means nothing
to me at that
point. I don't
give a fuck about how
stop
down
it.
You
stop,
are.
Stop right now. Like,
has Jeff Bezos ended world hunger?
Not
no.
Today. Oh, God. I hate them so much. And the fact that they can't, like, the fact that they look in their mirror and they're not sickened with self-disgust.
I hope there are any billionaires listening to their podcast.
Genuinely, though, like,
yeah,
it's not cool.
Yeah.
Your wealth is a scam.
Yeah.
We're all suffering and you suck.
Yeah. If anybody's into capitalism, you should probably stop listening.
Yeah. All right, so I've got one last, like, cerebral point.
Love a cerebral point.
I mean, what kind of podcast would this be? So this is from this article that I read called Slippery When Wet, The Shifting Boundaries of the Pornographic, A Class Analysis. And so this was, like, quite a long piece, and there was lots in it that was really, like, it was really good. I really enjoyed it. But something that stood out to me as, like, an overarching thing to consider in this discussion around class and romance and erotica was kind of this idea of, like, when we talk about what is erotica and what is pornography, the sort of classic feminist discourse around that often overlooks a really classist element when it comes to, like, what is considered to be legitimate and what's considered to be illegitimate, like, culture, essentially. And it kind of ties into this idea that we've spoken to about before about, like, what is highbrow and what is lowbrow, essentially. Or what is art and what is smut is kind of like this dichotomy. And so reading some of the quotes from these sort of, like, really well-known feminists who and I'm sure you also have some issues with, and talking like Dworkin and, like, McKinnon and whatnot. Yeah. So, like, quite prominent feminists in, like, the porn wars of second wave feminism, and how a lot of their disgust that was expressed around pornography or anything to do with sex, sex workers, any kind of eroticism, and this idea of this disgust being, like, grounded in not just a gendered thing, because it's often just framed as a gendered thing, but really that being, like, coming down to this class issue of it being, like, it's not high art, it's just filth of the body, essentially. It's violent, it's rough, loveless, it's the, quotations, bad kind of sex, whereas something that's, you know, perceived as art is kind of like this lovemaking, or, like, the good kind of sex, with, like, the nuance and the nice lighting and the angles and all of the artistic prose around it.
And I think you can still see it in things today with, like, the difference between bondage and shibari, for instance.
Yeah.
Like, you know, oh, if you're a rigger, then, you know, it's high art that you're kind of doing these things, because maybe you tie someone up, but you don't stick anything in an orifice, and therefore it's art.
You tie someone up and you just take beautiful black and white photography of it.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, like, fucking love it. Froth here shibari for it.
Yeah,
here for it. Absolutely. And I do think it's beautiful, but, you know, there's a real, I think we need to really question when we're making those judgment calls about what is high art, it's just erotic art, and what is smut and should be kind of looked down on.
Yeah, definitely. It's so important to recognize that there is, like, there's a hierarchy, there's a social hierarchy of what is and isn't art, and that things to do with sex play a part in that. Mm. And also what struck me as well when reading about this and when listening to you talk about this is, like, if you remember when we were talking about Fanny Hill, which is essentially the story, a romanticized story about the life of a sex worker back in, like, what, the 16th, 17th century, and a lot of early, like, erotic literature works were, that is inherently caught up in dialogue around class, because all kinds of conversations around sex work to this day is still wrapped up in ideas of class and stigma around class. So I had a point.
No, I think that's really interesting, though. We haven't really spoken about sex work thus far on the episode, but it is something that is so wrapped up in class and class wars, and around the choice to be a sex worker and things like that, that I think people need to keep in mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, if by the end of this episode we haven't ruined most erotic stories for you, probably not doing our job.
We'll get there eventually. Would you fuck a billionaire?
I don't see how I would like a billionaire. Yeah. Well,
I mean, good luck having a fantasy about anything now.
Bye.
Books loved.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at UH1.com.